This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. When a rusty 150-foot freighter ran aground in shallow waters off Queens in 1993 and half-starved Chinese passengers began scrambling from its decks, it was the largest arrival of illegal immigrants in modern times. Our guest, writer Patrick Radden Keefe, says the dramatic landing revealed something then little known to the public: a massive immigration to the U.S. from a relatively small region in southern China that had been underway for more than a decade. The influx from the Chinese province of Fujian altered the character of New York's Chinatown and made a fortune for the human traffickers who brought the immigrants to American shores. Among the most successful of the traffickers, often called snakeheads, was a middle-aged Chinese woman known in the community simply as Sister Ping. Patrick Radden Keefe is a writer who focuses on international security, immigration, and espionage. He's a contributor to Slate, The New Yorker, and other publications, and is a commentator on NPR. His new book is called The Snakehead, an epic tale of the Chinatown underworld and the American dream. Well, Patrick Radden Keefe, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to begin by describing this bizarre moment in June of 1993, in the middle of a Saturday night, when these two police officers on the Rockaway Peninsula in Queens come upon this strange sight.
Well, Rockaway is a strange corner of New York City. It's a really quiet little area with a beach that faces out onto the Atlantic. You wouldn't know you were in this major metropolitan area. And in the dead of the night, just a few hours before dawn, these two park police officers were driving their car, just doing a routine patrol, and they looked out to sea, and they saw that there was actually a tramp steamer, a ship, that had run aground about 150 yards offshore. And what they realized, they started hearing screams, and they realized that people were actually jumping off of the ship and into the water. The surf was really rough at that point, and these people were trying to swim into shore, and some of them were drowning. And so it was kind of a almost ghoulish specter for these officers when they made this discovery and then immediately radioed for backup and actually jumped into the surf trying to save these people.
And as they began to reach them and pulled them ashore, who were these folks?
They couldn't tell at first, but what they noticed was that these people were Asian and in fact Chinese, all of them. And they were terrified. They were emaciated. They were in pretty bad physical condition. And as they pulled more and more of these people to shore, first of all, they realized that there were hundreds of them, that this was a fairly small ship. I mean, it was about 150 feet long. But hundreds of people, ultimately almost 300, had been in the hold of the ship and made a journey. And they were in pretty terrible shape as they collapsed on the sand. And they were Chinese. They had come from China.
And when authorities got aboard the vessel, what did they see? What did they figure out?
Well, they started rounding up the passengers and trying to figure out where they'd come from. I mean, what was this kind of phantom ship that had washed up on the shores of New York? But they actually got onto the ship and they started questioning some of the people on board and finding interpreters who could speak to them in Chinese, and found out that they had come all the way from Thailand. And they'd actually come to America. They'd sort of gone the wrong way around the world, if you can imagine it. I mean, if you were in Thailand or China and you wanted to go to the United States, the smart thing to do would be to go east and cross the Pacific to California. But they'd gone west, down around Singapore, up through the Strait of Malacca, across the Indian Ocean to Africa, down around the Cape of Good Hope, back up across the Atlantic. So it was a 17,000-mile journey. And they wondered how long these people had been on the ship, and they found out they'd actually been in the hold of the ship for 120 days.
And when they looked in the hold of the ship, what did they see?
Well, the hold was this dark area which had been segmented into two levels. There were sort of steel struts, and they'd actually put plywood out, and people had been living in this space for months. Their belongings were there. It was a pretty dirty and dangerous environment. I mean, there were basically people. Each person had about a 2-foot by 6-foot space on this plywood in which to live for months. There was one bathroom on the ship, but that was for use only by the women. There were a small number of women, about 24 women on board. And the men on the ship either had to go up on board and go to the bathroom or actually do it right there in the space that they were all living in. It was a mess. It was terrifying to think that people had been living in these conditions.
And so what happened to the passengers, you know, that night in the coming days?
Well, the passengers had thought that if they could set foot on American soil and ask for political asylum, they would have an opportunity to go and hear their claims heard. And during the time it took for that asylum hearing to get set up, they would actually be released into the community. But that didn't happen. With the ship arriving in this very dramatic manner, it was a major embarrassment for the Clinton administration, which had then been in office for only about 6 months and in fact had not yet appointed a director of the INS. And so what happened was that en masse, these 290 or so passengers who'd come all the way from Asia on this journey were thrown into prisons in America. And many of them actually remained in prison for the next 4 years.
Now, these folks had in the main come from Fujian. Am I pronouncing this right, this province in southern China?
Yeah, Fujian, yeah.
Fujian. And to give us a sense of the scale of immigration from that part of China in the 80s and 90s and why so many came from that area.
Well, what started to happen in the early 1980s is that people started turning up in New York's Chinatown from Fujian province, which is a small sliver of a province in southeastern China. It's right across the strait from Taiwan. And people started turning up in Chinatown. Now, Chinatown at that point had for a century, this is New York's Chinatown, been a very Cantonese community. Most people had been here for a long time and they'd come from you know, around what is today Guangzhou. But these Fujianese started showing up first in small numbers and then basically sending for their families. And more people came. There's a great Fujianese expression, which is one brings 10, 10 bring 100. And they really put that into practice right through the sort of mid-1980s and into the 90s. And nobody really knows, because many of these people were coming illegally, how many ultimately came. And I think that when you're looking at these kinds of underground economies and human smuggling, it's really difficult to assign hard numbers to anything. But just to give you a sense of the scale, in the mid-1990s, the CIA estimated that roughly 100,000 people were coming illegally to the United States from this part of China every year.
And you write that when these people from Fujian went to Chinatown in New York, rather than integrating within the existing Cantonese community, they tended to build their own neighborhoods. And you also say that if you drove through, you could recognize the Fujianese, that they had a distinct appearance. How could you tell?
Well, I mean, I should say, first of all, that I'm not certain that you or I could necessarily, but people in Chinatown certainly could. And the Cantonese, what was then the Cantonese majority, which was fairly entrenched in the neighborhood, certainly could, because they looked literally as if they were off the boat. These were people who had come from a sort of relatively poor area in southeast China. A lot of them didn't have a lot of education. They had done anything they could to flee China. They'd endured some pretty terrifying conditions getting to the United States. And the ones who'd come illegally, and that was many of them, had paid smugglers to bring them. And the fee at the time in the 1980s was $18,000 per person. And the Cantonese looked down their noses at these, what they perceived as these kind of arrivistes from the countryside who had actually paid to be here. And they actually referred to them as $18,000 men, these new arrivals.
They were thinner, you say, working in menial jobs?
Yeah, exactly. And dressed not in the American fashion, but sort of more like people who came from the very villages that they had left behind. And they tended to cluster in a pretty insular corner in New York's Chinatown, which is sort of, if you know the area, is kind of east of the Bowery. It was sort of the eastern fringe. And they spoke their own dialect. I mean, this was the other thing. So in a way, it was a kind of a ghetto within a ghetto that emerged during these years.
Now, imagine these folks who came from China were pretty poor before they set out and could not readily assemble $18,000 for the journey. How did they pay back the cost of getting transported over?
Well, you're right. They couldn't come up with the fee in totality before they left. So the way it was structured is you'd make a small down payment of, say, $2,000 or $3,000 before you left to the smugglers. And the smugglers would bring you over. And if you made it safely, you owed the balance of that fee. There's a misunderstanding about this business, the human smuggling business, which is that people would get the idea is that people would get over here and effectively be indentured to the smugglers who brought them, that they would work as virtual slaves, paying off the debts. But if you think about it from the smuggler's point of view, that doesn't really make any sense. I mean, if you're a human smuggler and you're bringing lots of people, perhaps thousands of people to the country, you don't want to spend years chasing after various debtors. So instead, what would happen is you'd have people come over and basically get a grace period, a 72-hour window. And during that time, they'd get a telephone and they basically had to call everybody they knew, friends, family. If they didn't have friends or family to call, then maybe a loan shark, and come up with the balance of that fee. And then they would go out into the community and have to work like crazy to pay off the people they'd borrowed from. So they were indentured in a sense, but it was to these people that they had borrowed from, not to the smugglers. And they worked around the clock, 7 days a week, generally in restaurants and garment factories. And that was the way they paid off these debts.
What was the impact on the villages that these folks left? I mean, did some of them become depopulated?
They did. It was really interesting the way it developed. At first, what happened is that you had these villages which would have some residents leave, and they would go to the United States. And at that time, particularly during the 80s and 90s, I mean, this was before the economic boom we've heard so much about in the last decade or so had really taken hold. You could make, as a dishwasher in New York City, in a year, what you might make as a laborer back in Fujian province in a decade. So people were sending back their currency, and what would happen is that the families who received this money from abroad would build these large, quite ostentatious houses, mansions really, in these rural villages. And so you'd get these 4 or 5-story mansions that would rise out of the rice paddies looking just incredibly incongruous. And everybody in town, everybody in the village who would see this mansion would realize, well, that person has family in America. And eventually more and more people started leaving, and there was a kind of keeping up with the Joneses aspect to this, where at a certain point, if you didn't have such a house, if you didn't have relatives in the United States, then that said something about your family. It said that you weren't very enterprising, you weren't a risk taker, you weren't out there trying to kind of get the brass ring. But then ironically, more and more of these palaces would be built in these little rural villages, and eventually the villages emptied out. And a lot of the palaces ended up sort of boarded up. There's hardly anyone around because most of them are actually in the United States.
Why would people send enough money back to China to build mansions there rather than, you know, advancing their ambitions in life in the U.S.?
I think it's complicated. To some extent, it was actually a form of kind of honoring the family and the home village to send this money home. There's a statue in downtown Changlo. Changlo is one of the really big population centers just outside Fuzhou, where really everyone in Changlo knows somebody in the United States. So many people have left there to come here. And at one of the major intersections, there's a huge statue, this big soaring sail on a sailboat. It's this massive steel sail, and it has 2 little airplane wings. And when I was driving through, I asked the woman who was driving me, what is that? What's that monument? She said, oh, it's a monument that we've erected to the many people who left Changlo on planes and in boats because they've sent so much money back that we owe our prosperity today to them. So there were some very complicated dynamics, I think, driving both the decision for people to leave and then also once they left, their decision to send so much money back.
Now, your story deals a lot with the people who smuggle immigrants from southern China into the United States and in particular into Chinatown. And the Don Corleone, if you will, of this world is a little middle-aged woman who goes by the name of Sister Ping. Tell us about her.
Well, Sister Ping was a woman who'd come from Fujian province to the United States, and she herself had come legally with a visa in 1981. And she settled on the eastern fringe of Chinatown in this, at the time, sort of fairly small Fujianese community of people from her home province. And she opened up a little shop which was a sort of convenience store. It had clothing and sort of simple goods. And she also would cook traditional Fujianese food for some of these Fujianese people living in the community, who in some ways kind of almost nostalgically would go to the shop to get a taste of the region they had left behind. But almost immediately, she started sending for people. And at the time, it was very difficult to legally bring people from Fujian province into the U.S., for people to get visas to do so. And so illegally, she figured out ways of getting people in. And initially, it was just family, immediate family, then extended family, then people from her village, then people from the surrounding villages, and ultimately people from all over the region. And she got very good at this and within Chinatown developed a reputation as somebody who was just exceedingly clever at smuggling people out of China and into Chinatown. And as word spread, she was actually able to command a higher and higher price for these services. And nobody knows precisely how many people she ultimately brought. But again, with the caveat that you want to be careful throwing around numbers here, and all of this math is emphatically back of the envelope. The FBI estimates that she made about $40 million ultimately doing this.
Now, and she was what you call a snakehead, which means
she
what?
Was a snakehead. Yes, I mean, she was a lot of things, but she was above all an entrepreneur, and she had a restaurant, and to this day the restaurant is in Chinatown. You can go there; it's quite good. And a little real estate company and a legitimate travel agency. And she was a snakehead who would smuggle people in. And then the other thing she did is she had an underground bank as well. So she would smuggle customers in from China, and then they would work very hard in the United States and save their money, and they would want to send it back to China. And it was sort of a full-service operation, because if you saved U.S. dollars, if you had $1,000 and you wanted to send it back to your family in China, you would then take it not to Western Union or to a bank, but back to Sister Ping's restaurant. And if you gave it to her for a very small commission, she would forward that money on to your family back in China.
So snakehead meant a smuggler. I mean, it's such a sinister-sounding term. What was it, something that one wanted to say with contempt or respect?
With respect. And this is one of the mysterious and peculiar aspects of this story, is that Sister Ping, who in the mind of your average law enforcement agent, was a big criminal kingpin, a kind of malevolent figure. In Chinatown, she developed a reputation as an almost altruistic pillar of the community, because ultimately she provided a service and she enabled really a generation of people to flee very difficult circumstances and to build new lives in America.
Well, and it's interesting, as you describe her operation, she had family members in various places throughout the world, in Hong Kong, in Latin America, and people would get from one point to another and then sometimes be transported by airplane or overland. And you note that she had a reputation for quality, if you will. I mean, a commitment to get you there. And there were moments when people might have gotten stuck in some far-flung leg of the journey, and she would wire $10,000 if they needed to get them loose.
Exactly. I mean, the nature of the business is such that there's a very high level of risk entailed. And so Sister Ping, even though there were mishaps and even though things went wrong, she was perceived as a less risky broker than some of the others, that she was able to move people through all these different routes. If you did get stuck, she would send money. If you were caught by immigration and sent back, she would sometimes allow you to go for free the next time. Hmm. So there were some peculiar ways in which she set herself out from the pack.
Now, to what extent did she associate with ruthless criminals, some of these gangs in Chinatown that you write about? And if so, why would she associate with them?
Well, something funny happened with Sister Ping's business, which is that when she started out in the 80s, she was very good and very hands-on. And it was, I think, through this attention to detail that she gained a reputation as being a very good snakehead. But that led to a great increase in demand, particularly after Tiananmen Square in 1989, and more people wanted to pay her to bring them to the United States, to the point where the going fee, which had been $18,000 in the 80s, actually jumped to $35,000 in the 90s. And at that point, she really needed to start subcontracting some of the business just in order to keep pace with demand. And so she started working with a very violent street gang in Chinatown, a Fujianese gang known as the Fuqing. And the head of the Fuqing gang was a murderer and an extortionist, a guy who was a real opportunist and a pretty brutal character whose name was Ake. And he was very feared in the neighborhood. But he happened to be getting into the smuggling trade, and his gang members were able to handle some of the logistics that had grown sort of so immense in terms of all of the people who wanted to pay Sister Ping that she just couldn't possibly attend to all of it herself. And so at that point, she went into business with this gang.
Wouldn't authorities in New York have noticed this explosion in the population and the growth in crime and asked the feds to get on this?
They did. I mean, I think one problem for law enforcement was that the snakeheads were incredibly sophisticated. They ran these multinational, ever-adapting networks of people where they had contacts in dozens of countries, and they could really, at the spur of the moment, they could change their tactics and adapt very quickly to whatever law enforcement was doing. And in that respect, they were on an almost at the level of their kind of organizational DNA, they were the opposite of the federal government. They weren't hierarchical. They weren't hidebound. They didn't need to ask permission from anyone. And that mismatch, that asymmetry, made it incredibly hard, and I think to some extent still does today, for federal authorities to pursue them. And then the ship arrives and everything changes. Suddenly there's new momentum and an effort to stop the ships coming and to go after snakeheads like Sister Ping.
And law enforcement decided after this spectacular event to really crack down on the smugglers and on some of the organized crime connections that existed in Chinatown. And you describe in the book a whole series of arrests and prosecutions. And indeed, an indictment was returned on Sister Ping, I mean this elderly smuggler who fled to China where she stayed for many years. What kind of life did she lead in China?
A pretty good one. She Sister Ping really, truly was always one step ahead of the authorities. She fled on the eve of this indictment coming down in 1994 and basically went back to the village that she had left and moved back into the family's big mansion and continued doing her business. The FBI knew exactly where she was and would make appeals to Beijing to do something about it, but she had protection. And the other thing that was happening is that because so many of her customers were remitting large amounts of money back into the region, she was actually perceived as in some way, only somewhat indirectly, responsible for the new fortunes of the region because all of this money was pouring back in to invest in things in China. And you know, she was able to really travel around the world. She didn't use her own passport. She had a passport that she got from Belize with her photo and someone else's name, and she used that to make trips to foreign countries all over the world. And in fact, I found out, to travel in and out of the United States where she was wanted, where the FBI was looking for her, but nobody was able to find her.
And through a combination of guile and sources, the FBI managed to trick her, I guess, into Hong Kong, captured her, brought her back. She was tried, and then what finally happened when she was taken to court in New York?
Well, this was the kind of interesting wrinkle in Sister Ping's relationship with this gangster, Ake, who she had first encountered years before when they went into business with one another. Ake was arrested not too long after the Golden Venture came in. He'd been one of the really instrumental people in that operation and was arrested in 1993. And almost as soon as he was arrested, he agreed to cooperate with the FBI. And he said, effectively, I can give you Sister Ping. And she was somebody they really wanted. And it took them 7 years to arrest her. But eventually, after 7 years of chasing her around the globe, and then another five until they could get her into a courtroom in New York, in 2005, in the summer, there was a huge trial. And Ake was the star witness against Sister Ping. And she ended up being convicted and sentenced to 35 years in prison. She's now about 60, a little older than that. So she'll be in prison for the rest of her life. And one troubling footnote to this is that Ake pled guilty to five murders. I mean, he's a really violent individual. And after doing what the government wanted and pointing the finger at her in court, Ake was quietly released.
Help us understand the motivation for some of this immigration. You know, if paying $18,000, which was an enormous sum for a Chinese immigrant, to embark on this journey, which with such peril, many, you know, some died, many were caught and turned back. What drove them to undertake that kind of risk and expense? Were things so desperate in Fujian?
They were and they weren't. One of the wrinkles of this story and one of the kind of complications of the standard narrative here is that during the period of time I'm writing about, the economy in Fujian province was actually growing about 10% a year. So in fact, this was not by any stretch the poorest part of China. It wasn't really absolute poverty that was driving people out. There actually had been economic reforms in the region. And what was happening is that for the first time, really, some people were getting much wealthier than others. And demographers have actually looked at this and concluded that often it's not absolute poverty that makes people want to leave a place. It's what they call relative deprivation. And that sort of played into the keeping up with the Joneses thing, which I think drove a lot of people to leave. Having said that, how do you extrapolate from that to somebody actually going into debt and putting their life in the hands of an unscrupulous criminal? It's a difficult transition to make, and I've had a lot of conversations with people who did this trying to fathom what it was. And some of them say that they came for the freedom because they thought that living in these small communities where often there was a lot of corruption and party officials really called the shots. They wanted to go to a place where there was a lot more freedom. Some of them were seeking the economic opportunities. But I think that in Fujian province in particular, America also acquired an almost sort of fetish quality. There was a kind of vogue to it. And people were just dying to get here. And I think often they had wildly unrealistic senses of what America was actually like. And part of the reason for this was that after making these journeys, a lot of people would come and they would call home. And life wasn't actually all that great for them. They were working around the clock as dishwashers and living in flop houses in Chinatown. But they would call home, and you can imagine doing this yourself. Their family would say, how is it? And they wouldn't want to worry the family or make anyone think they'd made a mistake. So they would say, it's great. This is a terrific, prosperous country.
You know, there's been this explosion of economic growth in China and much more employment. Has immigration slowed? Is the day of the snakehead gone?
It definitely diminished over the last probably 5 years or so. I had this funny experience when I went to actually Thailand initially to do some research for the book. I was talking to some Thai officials and I said, oh, I'm here doing a research for a book on Chinese human smuggling. And they said, oh, smuggling people into China. Yes, it's a big problem. The suggestion was that the economy was growing so fast in China that why would people leave?
Getting them
and
in.
Yeah, exactly. And that was certainly echoed also in Fujian province when I went there. I mean, I spoke with a lot of people who said, oh, why would I want to go and live in New York's Chinatown and work as a dishwasher now when I could own a textile factory here in Fujian? So the business slowed down somewhat. But having said that, the whole story has changed in the last 6 or 8 months with the economic crisis because the manufacturing base in China has taken a huge hit, and in Southeast China in particular. And you're actually now seeing a really massive internal migration within China away from the coast. So all of these people who had been basically labor migrants working in the factories along the coast are going back to the villages, their ancestral villages, the villages they left behind. My hunch is, and I don't have any hard data to support this, but judging from the kind of larger arc of this story, that unless the economic situation improves, we are going to see an uptick in the snakehead trade. Because I think if you are getting people migrating back to the villages because ultimately there aren't enough opportunities on the coast, I think we'll also get people migrating out of China altogether.
Well, Patrick Radden-Keefe, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Patrick Radden-Keefe. His new book is called The Snakehead, an epic tale of the Chinatown underworld and the American dream. July was the deadliest month for U.S. troops in Afghanistan since the war began 8 years ago. The Obama administration has made the fight against a resurgent Taliban a priority, and beefed-up American forces are waging offensive actions in areas of the country where the Taliban has held sway for years. Top administration officials met with U.S. commanders over the weekend to assess how the war's going and consider whether even more troops may be needed. The U.S. and its NATO allies are also trying to develop Afghan security forces. in the hope they'll ultimately take over the battle with the Taliban and protect the civilian population. My guest, Ann Scott Tyson, is a military correspondent for The Washington Post, and she recently returned from 3 weeks embedded with U.S. Marines operating in the southern Afghan province of Helmand, a major opium-producing area where the Taliban is strong. Tyson observed U.S. military operations and the challenge of getting Afghan security forces into the effort. She reported recently that Afghan units are undermanned, and she says soldiers once recruited may disappear for weeks to visit their families or take their paychecks home to their villages. Tyson says drug use among the Afghan forces is also a problem. Some are discharged for opium use, but regular smoking of marijuana and hashish are tolerated. Well, Ann Scott Tyson, welcome to Fresh Air. When you've seen these Afghan security forces in action, what's your impression of their commitment and skill?
In the operations that I was on, the Afghan forces were sort of more of an adjunct to the U.S. They were not really operating independently. I mean, for example, going out on a local police patrol in a town in Helmand, it was really the Marines doing the patrol, and the there were six. They had to count them up. They got six policemen to go with them, and they were sort of more or less along for the ride. They weren't engaging with the people. They weren't actively policing the way the Marines want them to. I should also say that Afghan forces definitely can take the initiative in the same place I described the police patrol. I think one day a couple of officers were out buying lunch, and they happened to spot a drug deal taking place and followed the dealer, apprehended him, detained him. So they are showing signs of initiative. They're also, you know, can be quite enthusiastic, quite gung-ho, but they clearly have a different style, a different level of discipline. And they simply aren't capable of acting independently, at least in the south, where they're just starting to have Afghan forces flow in at this time.
And when you say different style, different type of discipline, you mean what?
Well, I mean, such as with their weapons. You know, the Afghans will maybe come under fire and they'll just unload. They won't take aim as well. They won't conserve their ammunition. They'll also be, you know, very cavalier. I mean, they'll be fighting on one hand and, you know, sort of playing dominoes, chasing chickens around on the other. So they simply don't have the focus and organization that the U.S. does.
You know, it's clear that this administration and the Pentagon these days has a focus on Afghanistan. There was a change in the military leadership there, a new commitment of troops. And they want to bring some of the counterinsurgency techniques that appear to have been so effective in Iraq to bear. I mean, in Iraq, of course, there was a big change under David Petraeus when there was a focus on protecting civilians rather than hunting and killing the enemy, moving troops into neighborhoods to protect civilians from sectarian violence, and then, of course, making arrangements with Sunni tribal leaders in some areas to fight with the Americans against the al-Qaeda in Iraq. To what extent do commanders think they can bring these techniques to Afghanistan?
I think that's at the forefront of their minds right now. And I do think that those concepts are trickling down and being embraced by the ordinary Marine and soldier on the ground. Most strikingly, the issue of civilian casualties and the sensitivity over that. Now, that difficulty of protecting civilians when you are in an active combat environment is one that, you know, where I think the tension is most highlighted with these young Marines who are in the middle of firefights. And yet over several days with them, I heard them time and again asking over the radio, do you see any civilians in that area? Are those shepherds? Do they look like legitimate shepherds? How many shepherds do you need for a flock of that size? Watch out for those women and children. Hold your fire. They're women and children. I heard that time and time again. So I think that is one of the most significant changes that they seem to really be taking to heart. Having said that, it's difficult and frustrating for them because they realize the extent to which the Taliban insurgents are taking advantage of their more stringent rules.
In a piece that you had recently, you had an interesting thought from David Petraeus, the general who was so successful in Iraq and now heads the Central Command. And he said, the biggest lesson of counterinsurgency is that every situation is unique. You have to be very careful that you have that nuanced understanding of the circumstances on the ground. Are there ways in which the circumstances in Afghanistan require a different kind of counterinsurgency approach than it did in Iraq?
Well, on one hand, it's because we have a rural environment. I mean, in Iraq, the population was centered in urban areas. So a platoon could get into a vacated building and be right there in the heart of the neighborhood where they could hear, you know, see, smell, witness everything going on around them. In Afghanistan, it's rural. So it's much more invasive for a unit like that to move into a village and maybe sort of culturally unacceptable. So they have to sort of stay more on the outskirts. And I think that makes it a little bit more difficult for them to be in this sort of protective role. For example, in an area I was just recently in until a few days ago, the Marines would have to go on patrols that were for several kilometers long out into remote villages. They were still going to villages where that this unit had sort of responsibility for the area, but they had never made their way there yet and would be, you know, they show up. A lot of the time the people run away. They're afraid. They won't speak to them in their homes. Maybe they won't speak to them at all or just off in a field. And they feel very much that when those Marines walk away and walk the even 3 or 4 kilometers back to their base, that they will be immediately visited by Taliban, who will, you know, ask them what happened and threaten them to not have that sort of contact. So I think the terrain and the rural nature of the insurgency in Afghanistan makes it difficult for that reason and in many other ways.
You know, one way is that commanders know that a counterinsurgency strategy is working is when local citizens start giving you intelligence and giving you critical information about, you know, the location of enemy forces, local customs, tribal alliances, terrain, back routes. Did you get any sense of whether the NATO forces are getting that kind of assistance from Afghan villagers in the areas where they've launched these new initiatives?
I think it is happening on a very small scale. I think it's not happening more than it's happening. I mean, for example, I believe that the villagers, through their own actions, showed that they knew when bombs were planted. They knew where they were. But they didn't, for the most part, tell the Marines that they were there.
These are the roadside bombs that are taking a lot of casualties among American forces.
Yes,
right? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So the Marines themselves would realize that if civilians were out using a particular road, that it was probably all right because they would know if there was something there. Similarly, the way that the Marines would know when they were about to get attacked is that all of the people would run off the fields. They would just vanish and disappear. So that means that they knew that they, you know, the Taliban had maneuvered into an area, was about to launch an attack on the Marines, but of course they wouldn't tell anyone in advance. They're just pretty much trying to survive.
You know, the other thing that was so effective in turning things around in Iraq were the alliances between American commanders and Sunni tribal leaders. Are we seeing that kind of thing happening in Afghanistan at all?
In some parts of the country, yes, I think that may be happening where the U.S. presence, the Allied presence has been there longer. Where I was, though, as the commanders put it, they were in the baby steps of counterinsurgency because they had simply just arrived. So they were trying to figure out who's who among the elders, among the tribes, for the very first time. They often didn't even know who was in charge. And my understanding is that the tribal structure in southern Afghanistan has been very much depleted through decades of fighting, that it's not very strong and in some cases has been supplanted by, you know, sort of narco traffickers and, you know, criminal type organizations. In the remote rural villages where the Marines were operating, it was just a matter of trying to find someone who could perhaps speak for the village, but there's no real functioning government of any sort. and really not much of a strong tribal presence or a community of elders that's meeting on any kind of regular basis. So there's just not a lot for them to tap into there.
Gosh, you know, it just seems like such a desperate situation for these villagers. And I would imagine that after decades of war, from the Soviets to, you know, the Taliban and others, that it would be really hard for them to believe that any, you know, foreign soldiers are really going to be there, you know, and be with them over the long haul.
Well, I think that their skepticism, you know, based on their history is probably pretty well-founded. And one other thing that really occurred to me, I mean, Helmand is a desert province. It's a very large area that reaches all the way down to the border with Pakistan. And for all extensive purposes, there really is no border that's controlled. And that's one of the problems, because the fighters from Pakistan flow freely over the border. But the key population center is located along the valley of the Helmand River, which is really quite a fertile area where they have a great deal of irrigation. Helmand used to be the breadbasket of Afghanistan. It's got a lot of potential. And one thing that struck me was that the villagers living there really have basically a decent life. I mean, they have livestock, they have fruit and vegetables growing. It's a very green, lush area that you wouldn't imagine not having been there. And so I think that makes it doubly difficult, because these people are surviving, they are living their lives, and they really don't have a great motivation to sort of toss in their lot with one side or the other.
As I read your description of some of these military actions by American forces in Helmand, this southern area where the Taliban has been so strong, it just seemed like such rough going. I mean, they would go out, engage the Taliban in an area, take casualties. They've been taking casualties on these improvised explosive devices on roads, but then aren't really in a position to get in and provide sustained protection to a civilian area. And I don't want to say that it sounded futile, but it certainly does seem like a long uphill climb to really make a sustained difference here. What's your sense of how the commanders view their prospects?
Well, the one company commander who I spent quite a bit of time with over recent days, that was his big point. This will take time. We can't rush this. He said that he felt he was not getting, you know, pressure from his higher-ups to do more than he could. I think on one hand, though, there is a sort of military dynamic. If you feel like you've seized the initiative, if you feel like you sort of have these Taliban forces, you know, you're sort of pushing them from one out of one area down to another, there is sort of a temptation to perhaps take it a bridge too far, go for that next village, go to push into the next bazaar, the next area, when in fact that's really not the purpose. And if you don't have enough forces, you can't do that. So in any case, this commander felt strongly that more time is required. He realized that he could only accomplish so much. I also think that there's a sense of pressure from the American public. July was the month of the greatest casualties for the U.S. military in Afghanistan since the beginning of the war. This clearly is creating pressure to achieve results there. And the defense secretary said, you know, we basically have this amount of time, maybe a year or so, to show that we're actually turning things around.
You know, we're a couple of weeks away from national elections in Afghanistan, and you were there, I assume, while campaigning was occurring. What's your sense of the extent to which people care about it, think it will affect their lives, and also what the American military's view is? Is it important to the American military effort?
It's a very important part of the American military effort in Afghanistan writ large. Where I was, I think that, you know, the election in the people's minds is pretty much irrelevant. Afghanistan is so highly decentralized. I believe that the villagers where I was, you know, perhaps they've heard of the Afghan governor in their province or the capital of Lashkar, but they are not at all in tune with the national political dynamic. And really, the Afghan government has been completely absent from their lives. They've been in areas where the Taliban has held sway, the Taliban has closed schools, the Taliban has sort of set down the law, and the Afghan government is very remote and really is not part of their daily reality.
Well, Ann Scott Tyson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Ann Scott Tyson is a military correspondent for The Washington Post. She recently returned from Afghanistan, where she was embedded with American Marines fighting the Taliban. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org.